Please be seated. Oh, you have a different grill for me today. Before I call the case for this afternoon, you will notice that the chair Shirley Abrahamson's son usually sits in is empty. She's not on the phone. She has withdrawn from participation. So we will sit six. Okay. I'm going to go through the drill, and you all look at it, too, to be sure we're all on the same page and at the time you think you're going to have, and we're all working at it together. Attorney Essenberg, you're going to have 35 minutes. Attorney Pines, you're going to have 25 minutes. Attorney Mandel, you're going to have 10 minutes. I warn you that 10 minutes is like nothing, so I hope you have one little thing you're going to focus on. And it's not like nothing as much as Attorney Bergston is 5 minutes, right?
Yes.
You can hardly take a breath. So I warn you, 5 minutes is going to be 5 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. So there's a lot to talk about in this case. So I can understand very much why you want to break it up. Okay, so I will call our last case for the day, Koschke versus Taylor. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. We are here this afternoon because the legislature has once again expressed a desire to control and limit rulemaking by the State Superintendent of Public Instruction and other agencies by enlisting another officer to check on that rulemaking. But under this court's order in Coyne versus Walker, it is unable to structure the delegation of its own legislative authority in the way that it seemed fit.
I thought, based on the news reports when you filed this lawsuit, that you filed it because members of the court had changed, and that's why we were here today.
That is not why we filed it. We filed it because of what continued. The legislature has continued to be frustrated in its ability to structure the delegation of its own authority, something that it need not do.
Well, if the legislature was so frustrated, couldn't the legislature have actually changed the language instead of this exact same language this court has already ruled on being repeated in the Rhines Act? And they could have figured out another way to say it. They chose not to. So we're at the same place we were prior to this with the last act, correct?
We are at the same place in the following sense. The legislature need not delegate rulemaking authority to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction or anyone else. The legislature has, I think, increasingly expressed a concern, as reflected in the Rains Act, but also a number of other provisions that were enacted in the last several years in reining in administrative rulemaking. I can surmise, and it's certainly within the legislature's prerogative to conclude, that agencies are subject to regulatory capture, including the Department of Public Instruction, and that it would be wise for them to enlist a more politically accountable officer to act as a check on that rulemaking. And it has turned to the governor, mirroring the process by which its own laws are enacted and signed into law. So it is certainly true that the legislature decided to double down, if you will, on its use of the governor and the Department of Administration as a check on agency rulemaking, but yet it may not do so because of the order in Coyne. Now, the problem, I think, and the reason that we're here, which is not because the composition of the court has changed, but because the court in Coyne was unable to agree on a constitutional principle that directs the people's elected representative not to do something that they otherwise would choose to do. The limitation on the legislature's ability to structure its delegation of its legislative authority as it deems proper is found nowhere in the text of Article 10, Section 1. We would respectfully submit it cannot be inferred from the history of that provision or the longstanding practice of the state of Wisconsin, and cannot even be found in a constitutional principle enunciated in Coyne to which a majority of the members of this court should agree. Under those circumstances, it seems to us appropriate to ask this court, and this is why we brought this original action, petition was granted, is why we're here today, to re-examine Coyne and to attempt to explain, if it can, if it agrees, why the legislature is not the master of the delegation of its own legislative authority.
In your brief, acknowledge, I think, that four justices agreed, at least to this premise, that that it was unconstitutional. The legislation at issue was unconstitutional. Are you asking for a reexamination of that?
Yes. Yes.
Well, isn't that the essence? I mean, come on. Isn't that the essence of what Coyne did? Page 28 of your brief. In Coyne versus Walker, Justice Gableman, Abrahamson, A.W. Bradley, and Justice Prosser agreed that the legislation at issue was unconstitutional. Now, there were divergences of opinions, but that was the holding of the case, that it was unconstitutional.
Clearly, there was an outcome in Coyne, and an injunction was complied with since the date of the decision. But when it comes to interpretation of our Constitution, and particularly when it comes to an order to a co-equal branch of government, that it is impaired in the way that it can delegate its own authority, it is, I think, appropriate for this court to reconsider whether or not that decision was correct.
To overturn that decision.
I will not. You're absolutely right, Justice Bradley. I will not beat around the bush. We're asking you to overrule Coyne.
I know. And I appreciate. I don't appreciate necessarily the argument, but I appreciate the candidness with which you put it forth. Because I found a little inconsistency on page 28 of your brief where you acknowledge there is a rule that comes out of Coyne, and yet on page, 36, you indicate, and I'll use your words, that it lacks a decision.
Well, there
it lacks a unifying analysis, but you got a decision. It's unconstitutional.
There clearly was an outcome in Coyne. Mm-hmm. There's a mandate, right? But there's no rationale in Coyne. There are competing constitutional principles that were cobbled together, but some justices believed A, some justices believed B, some justices believed C.
How about finely woven together rather than cobbled? I'm kind of teasing you. Yeah.
But they were woven together by no one person. They were, three justices felt that the state superintendent of public instruction had to be superior to any other officers. It's not, but a majority did not subscribe to that view. One justice, Justice Prosser, felt that the state superintendent of public instruction might have some inherent rulemaking authority, although he also said that that rulemaking authority could be countermanded by the legislature. Two justices expressed some approval of what Justice Prosser said in concurrence, but did not go so far as to endorse it. One justice thought that these other officers had to be Article 10 officers. That was Justice Gableman. It's not clear whether any other justices agreed with that proposition.
Counsel,
and so,
if I may, to revisit my first question, you wouldn't be here asking
a Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin to overturn a decision that it just made 2 years ago, if it were the same court, would you?
Any lawyer has to make strategic decisions about what is likely to be successful. And so, you know, it's sort of the same thing as filing a motion for reconsideration. It's sometimes you just have to conclude that you have to stop. But I don't think it is the case if there had been a majority decision in COIN agreeing on a rationale, and if that rationale was soundly based in the constitutional text, which, with respect, we believe that the outcome in COIN was not, then no, I don't think we would be here.
I hear you saying is that as long as it was a decision that you believed read the Constitution correctly, that only then is it precedent. But I think it's pretty clear that the outcome here was a decision by this court, by four members, that this is unconstitutional as applied to this officer, the SPI, the state superintendent. And regardless of whether you agree with that reading of the Constitution or not, and even regardless of whether we agree or not, that is the precedent that was set by COIN that you are asking us to overturn, correct?
We are asking you to overturn it, and we're asking you to overturn it for a number of reasons, one of which is that, of course, that we think the decision is unsound in principle. Another is that we believe it is unworkable in practice because it places the legislature in a very, very difficult position. If it is concerned, as it clearly is, given its doubling down on this principle and its enactment of a number of other laws which seek to rein in the power of administrative agencies about regulatory capture and agency overreach, it's now in a situation that unless it defines every P and Q, it must commit discretion to the agency when it delegates authority that it does not wish to permit. And so the legislature either has to do something which it thinks is inconsistent with the way in which it wants its delegated authority to be exercised, or it can decide that it simply will not delegate authority at all because the court has not permitted it to do so in a way that it sees fit. And as Justice Siegler pointed out in her dissent in COIN, that is not a victory for the State Department of Public Instruction, and it is not a victory of the state for the state of Wisconsin. And it is something that the ultimate lawgivers, the people, cannot easily correct. And so we believe that when we're talking about a constitutional decision, particularly one which handcuffs a co-equal branch of government, it becomes more necessary for that decision to be correct. And under circumstances where all we have is a mandate, we don't have agreement on a majority of the court as to why the people's elected representatives cannot do what they do.
Counsel, do you agree with opposing counsel that, setting aside the legislation that was at issue with COIN, that the two new provisions in the Wrens Act are being complied with by DPI?
The Wrens Act did a number of things. The Wrens Act reenacted the requirement that it essentially reenacted the requirement that the scope statement be submitted to the governor for final approval. But the things that were different in the Wrens Act were this intermediate step of submitting the scope statement to the Department of Administration. When we initially filed this petition, the Superintendent of Public Instruction was not submitting scope statements to the Department of Administration. They since have begun to do that, but...
And how about the complying with the request for public hearing? I don't know if there's been a request, but...
There have. In fact, we requested a public hearing.
Well, that was one of the parts of the Wrens Act that DPI was supposed to comply with.
What the DPI is not complying with is the requirements of Chapter 227, which are, with Act 21 and Act 57 put together, require that scope statements be submitted to the DOA, which then determines whether or not there's legal validity. It does some other things.
But if Coyne stands up, the reenactment makes no difference, right?
Yeah. If that is why I indicated to Justice Bradley that we are asking you to overrule the outcome in Coyne. We don't believe there was a rationale in Coyne, but we certainly are asking you to overrule the outcome.
When you say it's unworkable, Mr. Essenberg, really, didn't all the legislature have to do was potentially, well, make changes in general, which they chose not to do, and you said they doubled down, and I appreciate your candor, but isn't really all they would have had to do to try to make it workable was maybe put a time frame on the amount of time the governor had to look at it? I mean, isn't the real crux of this, despite your statement that there's no agreement on why it's unconstitutional, but isn't the crux of it that this superintendent is prevented from doing its job because the governor can essentially prevent them from making rules, a function that has been designated to the superintendent. That's how the superintendent functions. And so there are other ways that could have gone about this. And so when you say unworkable, which is a reason why we may overturn precedent, in the short time it's been instituted without any attempt to try to make it workable, how can you come to us and say it's unworkable, just throw it out the door?
I don't think there is a roadmap for what the legislature could do. It's not clear how one could get around the outcome in Coyne other than allowing the state superintendent of public instruction to make whatever rules he wants to make without the check of another officer.
What now, about a time limit on the governor's ability? I mean, the whole thing is it can be held up indefinitely.
But if they put a time limit on the governor's ability, but the governor nevertheless had the power to veto rulemaking, it's not clear that would be, I don't know whether what the Coyne court would have done with that. It's pretty clear that three justices would have said no, that you can't do that. I'm not sure about Justice Prosser because he seemed to base his conclusion on the fact that he thought that the changes wrought by Act 21 were not constructive. I don't know whether Justice Prosser would have come out differently had the legislature said, okay, the governor has to approve or not approve within 60 or 90 days. Don't know what he would have done.
So how is it unworkable? It's something that was in effect for, I don't know, how long was Act 21 in effect?
Act 21 was in effect for a very, very brief period of time.
Okay, so
I think it's fair to say it was the beginning of the walkthrough.
Okay, so how is it tell me how it's somehow, I mean, if you look at precedent, you look at our cases that talk about precedent, there's very few reasons why we should overturn precedent, especially as Justice Bradley pointed out, 2 years later or 3 years later. So I heard you say unworkable. That's a reason why we might overturn precedent. But usually in that situation, I don't know, it's been 20 years, 30 years. We've seen cases come through where we can't get to how this works in reality, how it works in practice. Tell me how it's unworkable.
I think it's unworkable because first of all, it seems to me that if we're going to tell the legislature that even with respect to delegation of its own authority, that it is not the master of how that power is to be exercised, there ought to be some clear warrant for that in the Constitution. And we see that the legislature over the years has struggled against what it believes, rightly or wrongly, maybe we disagree with the legislature, but it's quite clear that the legislature has believed that that it must act to restrain overreach and regulatory capture by administrative agencies. Coyne, for reasons that no majority could agree upon, tells the legislature that it may not respond to its concern. It may not do this. It must, if it chooses to delegate rulemaking at all, it has to do it and be subject to whatever the state superintendent of public instruction does when it is restraining the administrative agency, and the potential for administrative overreach is the very reason that it enacted what it regarded as a procedural safeguard by having the governor act as a check. That makes it unworkable. I don't think we need to wait 5, 10, 15 years to understand that problem, because I think that the problem is apparent right now. And this court ought to be careful about overruling precedent. It ought not to do it lightly, but the fact is that it does do it from time to time and is more likely to do it when we're talking about a constitutional decision, and particularly a constitutional decision which departs as dramatically from the text as the mandate in COIN did. Our Constitution, Article 10, Section 1, confers no power on the state superintendent of public instruction.
Well, it confers the supervision of public instruction.
But we can infer, because we know that the executive power is vested in the governor, the legislative power is invested in the legislature, the judicial power is invested in this court, mm-hmm. in our unified court system, that supervision is something different. And this thing called supervision is vested not only in the state superintendent of public instruction, but such other officers that the legislature, without limitation,
are you suggesting that the governor is an officer of the DPI?
No. I don't suggest that the governor is an officer of the DPI.
Well, are you interpreting such other officers to be state treasurer? You know, I mean, isn't it such other officers in the DPI?
No, I don't believe, I'm not entirely sure that this court has ever even held that. The text of the Constitution is without qualification. It says that supervision is vested in the superintendent of public instruction and such other officers as the legislature may direct without limitation or qualification. And in fact, we know that there are many officers over the course of the years, most notably local school districts, local school boards, local superintendents, that have played a role in the supervision of public instruction. In fact, collectively, a much greater role historically than even the state superintendent of public instruction. So we start with a constitutional provision that says the legislature gets to decide who exercises the supervision. And the text of the Constitution goes beyond that and says that the legislature gets to decide what this supervision is. The powers and duties of the state superintendent of public instruction are prescribed by law. Since the state superintendent of public instruction is not a common law officer, that means that the legislature decides what this power of supervision is.
Does the term supervision have no independent meaning from what the legislature gives it?
I think as a direct and original matter, as a matter of the text, yes, the Constitution gives the legislature the ability to decide what supervision is, right? The legislature is to prescribe the power of the state superintendent by law. Now,
so if we agree with that, then essentially what we're saying is that when the when Article 10, Section 1 says that supervision of public instruction is vested in the superintendent of public instruction, we should read in the parenthetical whatever that means.
Whatever that means. Although I don't think that this court has to go quite that far to resolve this case. The court might conclude, as I think the Chief Justice concluded in her dissent in COIN, that it may be that the Constitution confers some nonspecific executive authority in the state superintendent of public instruction. But that authority cannot include delegated legislative authority. That would be inconsistent not only with the provision in Article 10, Section 1, that says the legislature prescribes the powers and the duties of the state superintendent of public instruction, but it would also be inconsistent with the vesting of legislative power within the legislative branch in Article 4, Section 1, and it would be inconsistent with longstanding practice in the state of Wisconsin, where the state superintendent of public instruction has never been the person who makes law with respect to public education.
Is there any difficulty or any problem with understanding supervision as being a subset of executive power?
Is there any problem with it being a subset of executive power? I think there could be a problem to the extent, may have been at least suggested by some of the various opinions that we've had on this issue over the years, that supervision means that the state superintendent of public instruction has the executive power with respect to public education, that the state superintendent of public instruction is in effect the governor of public education. It seems to me that would be inconsistent with
right.
the conferral of executive power on the governor.
If we looked at it and said, well, but for Article 10, Section 1, supervision of public instruction would fall under the mantle of the governor's authority because he has executive power. Would that be a proper way of looking at it?
I think that one could conclude that there is something called supervision that is less than executive power. It must necessarily be because the framers used a different term in Article 10, Section 1, that gives the state superintendent of public instruction some administrative authority, and that this places some limitation on the legislature to scale it back, right? So that the legislature could not render the state superintendent of public instruction superfluous. However, I think one could not conclude from that this means that the state superintendent of public instruction has some inherent or necessary authority to make rules, or that if the legislature delegates its rulemaking authority to the state superintendent of public instruction, that it must give it all to the state superintendent
and to
no one else.
That's a different question, right? So if superintendence is a subset of executive authority, that doesn't whether you get legislative authority as a consequence, right? Those would be different questions.
Right. I think that the whatever one thinks, whether one thinks there is some sort of reserved power of supervision in the state superintendent with which the legislature cannot disturb, it doesn't include delegated legislative authority, that with respect to that authority, the legislature is the master. It not only has the power to dictate the terms of its delegation, but also has the duty to do so.
My sense is, and I think of the words of, I'm paraphrasing, former Governor Lee Sherman Dreyfuss, who talked about education as being really the crown jewel of Wisconsin. He elucidated that other states have a variety of resources and variety of wealth, but what we have in Wisconsin is education. And he would point to, as I point to now, in my question to you, the history of education in this Wisconsin, in the state of Wisconsin, tying it to, of course, our Constitution, because we're here about a Constitution. In 1848, only four entities under our state Constitution were vested with authority: the judicial, executive, legislative, and the superintendent of public instruction. 1902, another constitutional speaking, if you will. And in 1902, where earlier it could be a partisan election, the amendment in 1902 said, no, we're going to have this nonpartisan. So this very special position, one of four entities in our Constitution, shall be nonpartisan. And it seems to me that the argument you're advancing really undermines the nonpartisan nature of the 1902 constitutional amendment and the unique and special vested authority of the superintendent in 1848. So that's my trip in history. Tell me why I'm wrong, that your argument isn't really stripping the nonpartisan nature of this special creature, entity.
The short answer is that the state superintendent of public instruction has always been subject to partisan officers. It has never been the case in the state of Wisconsin that the state superintendent of public instruction operates as an independent czar for public education who makes rules, policy, and laws. The rules, policy, and laws are made by the legislature. And
yes,
the legislature,
but in 1902, the people spoke. We want this position elected in our spring election. Nonpartisan. We want the Constitution. The amendment says we want this to be a nonpartisan position. And that it's being kicked around like a political football, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know if it's being kicked around like a football. It seems to me that it's one thing to say that we would like to elect the state superintendent of public instruction, that we would like the state superintendent of public instruction to be elected in the nonpartisan spring election cycle, which perhaps was more nonpartisan in 1902 than it is today. But it's quite another thing to say that this means that this independently elected officer cannot be checked by another partisan officer, or by a partisan officer, or by a partisan body. And in fact, the whole history of public education in Wisconsin and the history of the state superintendent of public instruction reveals that that can't possibly be so, because it has always been the legislature, a partisan elected body, who makes the law, who makes policy, and in this case decides to delegate or not to delegate rulemaking authority to the state superintendent of public instruction. I suppose it's possible that the people of the state of Wisconsin could have created the state superintendent of public instruction who would be free to do whatever he or she wants, to make the law with respect to public instruction, to be completely independent, but they didn't do that. And nothing in the history of the constitutional debates, nothing in the history of the 1902 amendment, and nothing in the practice of this state for 170 years comes close to establishing that. And so simply to say that the state superintendent of public instruction has to be independently elected and ought to be elected in the nonpartisan election simply doesn't do the work of establishing that officer as someone who has either inherent authority to make rules, or if the legislature decides to delegate rulemaking authority, which it need not do, is somehow able or free from the limitations and procedural safeguards that the legislature might put upon that delegation of authority.
What does shall be vested then mean? I mean, looking at the text, shall be the supervision of public instruction shall be vested in a state superintendent. So what does it mean if it doesn't give them the rulemaking authority, which is how they function? If you take away the rulemaking authority, well, I guess two questions. What does that mean? And I heard you say the legislature can't render it superfluous, but if by making sure they can't pass any of their rules, isn't that making it superfluous?
Well, first of all, the constitutional text says it shall be vested in the state superintendent of public instruction and such other officers. The powers, what constitutes supervision is prescribed by law. The legislature is the master of that. The legislature need not delegate rulemaking authority. This court has never held that the legislature has some responsibility to delegate rulemaking authority to any administrative agency, including the state superintendent of public instruction, and it would, I think, be an interference with the conferral of legislative power on the legislature in Article 4, Section 1 for that to happen.
You say that nothing in the constitutional debates suggests contrary to your argument, but the Education Committee in the 1848 Constitutional Convention recommended that the governor be the entity that would appoint the superintendent. And the convention rejected that idea, instead gave under the Constitution, it created a superintendent of public instruction that was independent of gubernatorial supervision. So I disagree that the constitutional debates are nothing reflect that there should be some separation between the governor. In fact, they rejected the very idea that's being advanced today, or part of it.
But I don't know that the election of the state superintendent of public instruction necessarily tells us anything about what his powers should be, particularly given the fact that Article 10, Section 1 places them in the hands of the legislature. That very Constitutional Committee on Education and School Funds in the Constitutional Convention, we know from the Journal of the Convention, which was cited in the Attorney General's brief, agreed that the superintendent should have nothing to do with the machinery of the school system or the management of school funds. And so, how you select the state superintendent and the power that the state superintendent has are two different things. But to return to Justice Dalit's question, if I may, the legislature does not have to grant rulemaking. It can specify the standards that the state superintendent of public instruction needs to apply. It can direct the state superintendent of public instruction to do different things. There are many things that the state superintendent of public instruction could do, and in fact, a majority of this court in Coyne, Justice Gableman with the three dissenters, agreed that no rulemaking authority need be given to the state superintendent of public instruction. In fact, only Justice Prosser seemed to think that perhaps there was some inherent rulemaking authority. In fact, state law now, 227.10.2M, says that there's no implied authority to make rules, that there has to be express authorization. Well, I think that there are many, many things that the state superintendent of public instruction will be able to do. There are many duties that are prescribed directly by the legislature. There are many rules in place that the state superintendent of public instruction will be charged with enforcing. The DPI, as I understand it, has 600 employees. The DPI does many, many things, and it will continue to do so no matter what the outcome here is. I see my light is on.
It is. Thank you.
Chief Justice Rogensack, Justices of the Court, I'm Lester Pines of Pines Bach LLP. I represent the Superintendent of Public Instruction in this matter. I'm before the Court today with my colleague Beauregard Patterson, and the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Carolyn Taylor, is here in person. The question before the Court today is whether the will of the people will be enforced. The will of the people was expressed in the Constitution that was adopted in 1848. Article 10 was interpreted in 1996 in Thompson versus Craney. The will of the people in 1848 was this. The state of Wisconsin was not going to have the governor in charge of public instruction. As was noted, the Committee on Education considered and rejected having the superintendent appointed by the governor, which would have made the superintendent operate under the supervision of the governor. Now, Justice Kelly asked the critical question about the will of the people. And we have discussed briefly so far the structure of state government. The structure of state government is this. You have vested judicial authority, the unified court system. The legislature has vested legislative authority. The governor has vested executive authority. The only other place where the word vested is used in the Wisconsin Constitution is in Article 10 with regard to the superintendent of public instruction. Vested means the same thing for you, for the governor, for the legislature, for the superintendent. There is not a different definition of the word vested. There was not a different definition of the word vested in 1848.
What about a difference in the word authority versus supervision? Supervision is vested.
That's correct. Supervision is vested. The supervision of public instruction is vested in a state superintendent of public instruction and such other officers as the legislature shall direct, which I'm going to come back to in a second. I want the court to imagine who would have been in charge of public instruction if Article 10 had not been adopted. Who would have been the supervisor of public instruction if Article 10 had not been adopted? It would have to have been the governor.
Could have been the legislature. Why not the legislature?
The legislature does not have executive authority. The legislature has legislative authority.
That's right, but what we're fighting about here today is legislative authority. So
actually,
you're arguing that the superintendent of public instruction needs to have at least discretion on exercising a certain amount of legislative authority.
That is not what I'm arguing.
Okay.
What I'm arguing is, when the legislature gives authority to promulgate administrative rules, and in this case, it has given the authority to the superintendent in public instruction to promulgate administrative rules, the legislature cannot then make the governor, another executive branch officer, the supervisor of the superintendent. That's different than saying the legislature can't supervise the superintendent. The legislature does supervise the superintendent. The legislature could take away from the superintendent the authority to make administrative rules. The legislature could then take all the administrative rules that have been made and enact them into statutes. And if that occurred,
the governor could veto it.
That's correct. The governor could do that.
So why can't the governor veto rules?
Because there's no legislative authority to override a veto. A veto is a veto unless the legislature overrides it.
The legislature could enact the rules that the governor vetoed. Could they not?
They could, as statutes, they could enact as statutes the rules. They could do that. The governor could sign the bill or veto the bill. In this instance, where the legislature has delegated the responsibility to the superintendent to make administrative rules, they have then said the governor has absolutely unfettered authority to stop the entire process. Unfettered authority, which makes the governor the supervisor of public instruction, because
there's more to supervising public instruction than rulemaking, is there not?
Yes, but it is agreed, and it's not. There's no disagreement between the parties here, and I think that the court has already previously talked about this. Administrative rules are the way in which the laws of the legislature are carried out. The superintendent of public instruction supervises through rules and the enforcement of rules. If you put the governor in charge of whether or not a rule can be enacted, basically the legislature has given the governor the authority to tell the superintendent what he or she may or may not do.
If the legislature clawed back the delegation of authority to the SPI and DPI to promulgate rules, would it be offending the Constitution? Because it seems to me like you are trying to convert a statutory delegation of power or a statutory power into a constitutional one.
The legislature has the absolute authority to claw back to take back the authority of the superintendent of public instruction, or for that matter, the governor and the governor's cabinet, from proposing any administrative rule whatsoever.
Would they be interfering with the constitutional powers of the SPI?
If they did that, no. But Thompson versus Craney said that other officers to whom supervision of public instruction could, that the definition of other officers in Article 10 was subordinate officers, officers who are subordinate to the superintendent. That's the holding in Thompson. That was a unanimous holding. It's untouched since 1996 when I argued it in this chambers. It's untouched. That's the law of this state. What the legislature did in Act 57 was to elevate an officer, the governor, to a position where the governor directed the superintendent as to what the superintendent could do with regard to an element of supervision.
But that's not what this legislation does.
Yes, it is.
How?
Because it gives the governor the authority, absolutely, to say you can't even propose an administrative rule.
So this goes to the distinction, I think, executive and legislative power, right? So there's the suggestion that if the supervisor does not have rulemaking authority, then the supervisor can't do anything. But I want to push back on that a little bit. Let's do the counterfactual. Let's say the legislature clawed back all rulemaking authority and said, you know what? We'll just take care of making the laws. The legislature says, we'll just take care of making the laws. SPI, DPI, you're not making any rules, you're not making any laws, we'll make all of those.
Okay.
It seems to me that the SPI would still, day to day, have an awful lot to do because the nature of their authority is not legislative but executive. Their days would be filled with executing the laws adopted by the legislature.
That's correct.
Right? Okay. So then what I'm wondering is, why would we say that if the SBI cannot engage in rulemaking, it wouldn't be able to do its job?
Our position is not, I want to make it absolutely clear to the court, we are not saying that the superintendent of public instruction must be given by the legislature rulemaking authority.
Mm-hmm.
What we are saying is the legislature has for decades given the superintendent of public instruction rulemaking authority.
Right.
Now, in 2011, in Act 21, the legislature added a layer and said, despite the fact that we know that an element of supervision of public instruction is rulemaking, and we have given this to the superintendent to do, and we are keeping that power with the superintendent, we are also appointing an officer to oversee the superintendent in that exercise of that power.
Right. And let's be clear about what the power is. Right. That part of the power is legislative, not executive.
That's true. That's true, Justice Kelly.
Yeah.
But that's a legislative authority, which they have exercised. Once they've exercised the power to say you can make rules, that's done. They've given them that power.
Unless they put conditions on it.
Okay. That's right. The essence of the problem here is that the condition that they placed on it gives an officer superior power to the superintendent in exercising that authority.
Stop right there, because I think that's where I get lost. So help me through this. So when Act 21 or the Reins Act interposes the governor in the rulemaking process, it's not interposing it in the execution of the power. It's interposing it in the adoption of a law.
Well, no.
Right? So work with me on this. So So I see what we're doing here as having two sides in the SBI. They've got a rulemaking power and they've got an execution power. Right? So the Act 21 and Reins Act are dealing on the legislative, the lawmaking side of the power. Right? So now when we go through that process, we're entirely engaged in legislative function. Legislature's delegated some authority to SBI to engage in the rulemaking process. And that rulemaking process, that legislative function, does not cease until there is an adopted regulation. Now, the governor is interposed in that process, certainly. But that doesn't mean that there is an interposition of someone exercising superior executive authority. Once that rule is adopted, isn't there a different analysis then to decide, well, is the governor interfering with the execution of the law that was developed?
The governor is placed in the position to say to the superintendent, despite the fact that rulemaking authority is an element of supervision, and despite the fact that...
Where do we get that proposition from?
That has not been disputed in this case, that rulemaking authority, that is following Chapter 227, is not in dispute, that that is a way in which the superintendent exercises his supervision of public
instruction. Those are two different things, right? So it doesn't become a supervisory power simply because the legislature delegates the authority to do that. It is legislative power. And the legislature says, you can do that. That does not turn it into supervisory power. Supervisory power, as we were discussing before, supervisory power is executive power, not legislative.
Well, the rule, okay, if you want to start from that position, you're saying the superintendent of public instruction is exercising a delegated legislative power. Okay,
right,
fine. That delegated legislative power is the obligation to propose rules. That comes within the power of the superintendent to do.
Because
if we go back, to the first legislation adopted in 1848, the superintendent was, in that first legislation, given the power to make rules for libraries and so forth.
I believe it said proposed rules.
Proposed rules. Right then and there. Proposed rules. So if that was there in 1848, it's certainly there now.
Yes, but his proposal is not the same thing as enacting, is it?
No, it's the legislature that enacts the rules under Chapter 227. Justice Kelly, I don't think that one would say that when the cabinet officers of the governor are proposing rules that they're not engaging in executive authority. It's authority. The legislature has given them the authority to propose rules.
I actually don't think I would agree with that. I think they're exercising delegated legislative authority when they do that.
All right. Well, if we even assume that they're exercising delegated legislative authority, it is a power that the superintendent has, it cannot be separated from the rest of the superintendent's powers. But the fundamental question here, really, for you, Justice Kelly, is when you look at the Constitution and you look at the Convention in 1848, where this very system, where the governor would be supervising the superintendent, and when you look at rulemaking and what the essence of rulemaking is, which is making policy, and you see that now the governor has been given the authority to make the policy. It's a negative authority. It's a either do it my way or don't do it at all.
Right, which is the same thing the legislature could do itself if it chose not to delegate any authority. I don't see the difference.
But the legislature hasn't chosen not to do that.
Okay. So
what you're saying is the legislature can delegate its authority to the governor to say you can't make an administrative rule. And that's where we get into the problem of having the governor as an officer of public, a supervision of public instruction.
Why does that make him an officer of public instruction?
Because the development of the proposal, the development of a rule, and a rule expresses a policy position.
Which is a legislative function.
It is the superintendent's authority to develop policy functions for education.
If we struck the governor's participation in the RENS Act and left it where it is with DOA, would you be happy?
Yes.
Okay, so that's all you want is to get the governor out of here. You're not worried about all the other things that are in the RENS Act.
No. And I should point out that the RENS Act, I mean, that's a great acronym. It's, you know, it's Act 57 of 2017. You can give it a fun name, but it's just all it did was add that one provision in the statute we're looking at. The superintendent has complied with that, will continue to comply with it. It's giving the governor the policymaking authority over educational policy. And really, fundamentally, what we can talk about, well, this is a legislative authority, it's not a legislative authority. You're giving the governor in this statute the authority to make educational policy. And he is not an officer of the supervision of public instruction. That was carved out in 1848.
What would stop the legislature from enacting the rule, even if the governor said, I don't like the SPI's rule?
The legislature would never see the rule. We'd never see the scope statement. We'd never see the rule.
Well, what if they did? I mean, is there something that
I suppose they read the newspaper about a rule and then they decided they wanted to adopt a policy, I suppose they could.
I'm trying to focus on power.
Yeah.
And who has the power to do what? Because part of your argument was there's no veto override with the legislature. But what would preclude the legislature from saying, that's great, you've given your input, Governor, we're going to enact this rule anyway?
Well,
under
the current statute, the legislature would not have received the scope statement and would not have received the rule.
So would that change your argument if the rule were provided both to the governor and the legislature, and then the governor says no, and the legislature says, well, we're going to enact it anyway?
Well, I'm not in a position to give advice to the legislature, but it sure sounds better than what we've got. Right now, you've got an absolute veto on the part of the governor. Not even, I don't want to call it a veto.
But that's what he has with respect to any legislation.
But with regard to this rulemaking, there's no further legislative ability to override a veto.
But there is, because the superintendent could say, oh, you know, the governor isn't going to proceed with this. He won't give his approval. So I'm going to go talk to some legislators and see if I can get them to propose this rule in the form of legislation. And they could do that, right?
Well, anybody could do that. Yeah. Superintendent could do it.
So what I'm trying to understand is why the Constitution is offended by the governor having, I'll call it a veto, or he has an approval or he can reject the rule. He has that ability with respect to legislation. That doesn't offend the Constitution because the Constitution actually grants him that authority. So why is the Constitution offended when the legislature delegates rulemaking to an agency and then says, but you got to go to the governor and get his approval?
Because the essence of the supervision of public instruction that was given to us by the people in 1848 is that a superintendent of public instruction would be the place where public instruction was supervised. And to supervise that, you've got to have policies. And policies should be made by the superintendent, and policies should not be made by the governor. And if the governor can tell the superintendent, you can't even send this to the legislature. You can't send the scope statement. You can't send the rule. The governor is making the policy. That makes the governor an officer of supervision of public instruction. And in Thompson versus Craney, that's precisely what that case said the governor can't be. The legislature is not hamstrung. The legislature is not all bollocks up in its ability to do this. The legislature can figure out a way to do something that's constitutional. The whole notion that the legislature's hands are tied, please. The legislature can structure something. For example, I will give the legislature some advice. Perhaps that there should be consultation between the superintendent and the governor before the scope statement is sent. Perhaps there should be consultation with the superintendent and the governor before the rule is sent. That doesn't offend the Constitution. What offends the Constitution is making the governor the policymaker. And that's the absolute...
Is he the policymaker when he vetoes legislation?
You bet. He is the policymaker.
And the Constitution says that's okay.
That's right. Until the legislature says by two-thirds votes, you know what, Governor, you're wrong.
Right.
But with regard to making policy for education through the rulemaking process, there's no legislative oversight whatsoever.
How are you not transforming a statutory delegation of legislative authority from the legislature to an agency? You are transforming that into a constitutional power.
That's correct, because...
But then the legislature would offend the Constitution under your argument if they clawed back that rulemaking authority,
because,
that legislative delegation.
No, because Thompson versus Craney said two things. Number one, it said the legislature can give authority to the superintendent and can take it back.
That's all the legislature can do because this court said so?
That's the court. This court interprets the Wisconsin Constitution, and it made that interpretation 20 years ago. That's number one. Number two, Thompson versus Craney said you can't have an officer of public instruction who is superior to or equal to the superintendent. I don't know how you can look at this and not perceive that having the governor have the authority to stop the administrative rulemaking process is not making the governor an officer of the supervision of public instruction.
When the governor vetoes legislation, does that make him an arm of the legislature?
No. He vetoes the legislation. He has executive authority to do so. And if the legislature doesn't like what he did, the legislature has the final word. That's how it works, except that isn't how it works. That's not what the legislature did with rulemaking for the superintendent of public instruction, who himself or herself has a vested authority. Let's not lose sight of the word vested.
Vested authority.
Rulemaking is not vested by the Constitution in the state superintendent.
Authority
is
to supervise public instruction is vested.
Right.
Supervision. The phrase supervision has not changed since 1848. It means the same thing in 1848 as it means today.
Did it mean legislative in 1848?
The legislature had the power in 1848. There was no Administrative Procedure Act in 1848.
I know. But did the term supervise mean legislative power in 1848? Okay.
No.
Did it, at some point, did it take on the meaning of legislative power?
Yes.
When?
When the legislature delegated that authority to the superintendent.
Well, now this gets me back to the concern that Justice Rebecca Bradley was raising. It seems that you are saying that the legislature was able to change the constitutional nature of the term supervise, right? Because if a legislation changed a word that prior to that legislation did not mean legislative power, and after that legislation, that constitutional term supervise means legislative power, then you have promoted a legislative power to constitutional status, haven't you?
No, because, may I have my lights on?
Yeah, you can answer Justice Kelly's question.
The legislative power is as defined in the Administrative Procedures Act, is to allow administrative agencies to make policies based on the law that the legislature has enacted. And fundamentally, since the mid-20th century, administrative agencies have used that authority to make policy. And that's what the superintendent has been given by the legislature. The constitutional defect here is not that the that the word supervision is being revised. The constitutional defect is that the governor has been placed in a position of authority over the superintendent, which violates the Constitution as interpreted by this court, which says no officer can be given power equal to or superior to the superintendent. That's the rub here. That's the standard. That's the way to look at this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jeff Mandel, Stafford Rosenbaum, LLP, here on behalf of the COIN amici. Mindful of Chief Justice Rogensack's note that this time will go very quickly, I want to try to touch upon three things that Mr. Essenberg said. First, he said that the legislature is working here to create a politically accountable check on the superintendent of public instruction. But of course, such a check already exists. It's the quadrennial election that we have in this state where the people get to choose the superintendent. And that is a nonpartisan election, as has already been discussed here. What the problem with the legislation here is it is attempting to interpose a partisanly elected governor as that check. Second, As was discussed during Mr. Essenberg's time, and as he himself concedes, there is a clear mandate and rule from COIN. And that clear mandate and decision controls the very narrow issue that is at stake here. To the extent that petitioners complain that the COIN decision and the fractured
which
opinion...
Which rationale among the, I think... One, two, four opinions in the COIN decision. Which rationale would you have this court adopt?
Well, Justice Bradley, I don't think that that is a decision that needs to be made here.
Well, we do have an opinion to write.
Absolutely. The clear decision in COIN was that subjecting the SPI scope statement to gubernatorial pre-approval was unconstitutional. That's all that needs to be decided here. As Chief Justice Rogensack and Mr. Pines discussed in their colloquy, that's the very narrow issue here.
Yeah, we have to decide why, don't we?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest you could decide because it was decided in COIN.
Well, they didn't.
And that's the end of it.
But they didn't decide in COIN. There were several different reasons given. They are not even, I don't think they're even abutting, much less woven together. So we'd have to pick one of those, wouldn't we?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The very narrow question here was already decided. That in itself, the precedent is dispositive. Of course, I do not dispute.
So let's do a little bit of a thought experiment here. You are now assigned to write the majority opinion for this court. Why do you say this is unconstitutional?
I don't think the court needs to espouse a full explanation here. 2.5 years ago, the court espoused such an explanation.
But without any reasoning, don't you think the people of Wisconsin deserve to understand why we make the rulings that we make and what the Constitution means? Because there was no majority in the court. There wasn't even a plurality of the court saying what the Constitution means. There's vast disagreement.
Well, respectfully, Justice Bradley, I don't think that it is fair to say that there was nothing that was clear. Justice Gableman's opinion uses the phrase, we hold, twice.
Yes, and he was only
one. No one joined his opinion.
Yeah.
No one joined his opinion. But what we didn't see, as we sometimes see in other opinions, is a concurrence that said, I only join these paragraphs.
That's because no one joined any part of it. Justice Abrahamson made it quite clear. The Justice Gableman's opinion was the expression of one justice's thoughts.
But that doesn't mean that there was no agreement about any of it. It means that...
Justice Ziegler's dissent pointed out that actually Justice Gableman agreed with the three dissenters in great part. Should we take something from that and put it in this opinion?
Well, I think that Justice Gableman did agree with the dissenters in part, but not on the crucial question of whether the governor could hold this particular power. I don't think the question is whether individual justices agreed with every jot and tittle of Justice Gableman's opinion, of every individual word. But when you read the three opinions that supported the mandate, it is clear that there was agreement that what happened there was unconstitutional. To the extent that COIN left other questions about the constitutionality of how things work with the superintendent of public instruction unresolved, those questions remain unresolved, but they are not raised in this case, and they need not and should not be decided today.
Well, except that legislative acts are not just generally unconstitutional, right? We presume that they are constitutional. We accord that a pretty heavy presumption, actually. And we require people to come to us and describe with great specificity and quite clearly what the constitutional defect is. And in this court in COIN couldn't get four members of the court to figure out what that defect was. So if we are simply to take what COIN did and say we're not going to do an independent analysis, we're just going to say COIN already figured this out, I think it's fair for the people of Wisconsin to say, okay, well then, what's COIN say? And they go and they look at COIN and they go, well, COIN tells me the court doesn't know why this is unconstitutional. What are we supposed to do with that?
Your Honor, I have three responses to that, Justice Kelly. First of all, I don't think COIN is as unclear as you suggest. Second of all, to the extent that COIN decided the narrow question here, there doesn't need to be a new opinion. The case can be dismissed as improvidently granted. The question has been resolved constitutionally.
Mr. Rendell, there's new legislation that was enacted, presumably by the will of the people, and this court does not have the power to just say unconstitutional and not give a reason. We have to give a reason.
Justice Bradley, the new legislation is exactly the same as the old legislation, and that brings me to the third point I wanted to start about, which was stare decisis. There's been some discussion about that. I would urge the court to look carefully at the Fisher versus Horizon Horicon Iron and Manufacturing Company case that we cited in the amici brief. That is a case much like this one, where the court had legislation in front of it. It made a constitutional decision. The legislature later enacted similar legislation, and someone brought a constitutional challenge, and the court strongly held that stare decisis controlled. The court also expressly said that the current composition of the court at that time didn't agree with the policy, but that they felt that they were bound by the prior decision, by the Constitution, even though it was new legislation. And then lastly, I would just say,
was Fisher the result of a majority of the court?
Fisher,
as an opinion, so not what we call a plurality for us. Was Fisher the result of a majority decision?
Fisher appears to have been a unanimous opinion, Chief Justice Rogensack.
Okay.
And it's a little bit difficult, as you yourself, I'm sure, appreciate, that when you look back at these early opinions, they speak about we, but they also talk about I, and it can be a little bit thorny to figure out exactly what's going on, but it appears to have been unanimous. Mm-hmm. Lastly, Mr. Essenberg said several times that this court should be wary of stare decisis in the context of constitutional rulings. And I simply want to point out that not only does he have no Wisconsin authority for that whatsoever, it is contrary to Wisconsin law. And I would direct the court respectfully to the Freer case, which is discussed in our brief on page 11. That case says exactly the opposite of what Mr. Essenberg is arguing. It says that it is with respect to constitutional determinations that stare decisis is at its apex and should be respected most clearly. And I don't want to let pass Mr. Essenberg's repeated statement that this court shouldn't worry about the COIN decision simply because it's a constitutional decision. He's citing one relatively recent federal decision that is not Wisconsin law. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Got to raise it a little higher here.
Yeah, so you might want to even bring the mic up a little,
thank
counsel.
You.
There you go.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rogensack, other justices. My name is Rick Verstegen. I'm an attorney with Boardman and Clark in Madison. I'm honored to be at the Supreme Court, and I'm also honored to be representing two very important organizations in our state, the Wisconsin Association of School Boards and the Wisconsin School Administrators Alliance, who are both amici in this case. We appreciate the opportunity to file a brief and to participate in oral argument. Although what I have to say is very important, I also hope you feel that whom I'm saying it for is also very important. And in that respect, let me just tell you a little bit about WSB and SAA. WSB, or the School Boards Association, is a voluntary, non-stock corporation whose membership includes every school board in the state of Wisconsin, 422 school boards throughout the state. SAA is a statewide organization and its alliance of five different associations, each representing different school administrators. So you've got superintendents, building administrators, personnel administrators, individuals who represent those in pupil services, and business officials. WSB and SAA have one common mission, and that is providing the best public education for the students in this state. And that mission compels us to support DPI and the state superintendent in this case. It's also motivated six other organizations, educational organizations, to support our brief, which you'll find in the back of our appendix, in the back of our brief, which includes the Wisconsin Retired Educators Association, the Southeast Wisconsin Schools Alliance, the Wisconsin Alliance for Education Excellent Schools, Disability Rights of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance, and the Wisconsin Parent Teacher Association. Suffice it to say, almost the entire public education community is aligned and recognizes the importance of this case. Our brief contains two primary arguments. One argument has already been covered, stare decisis. I'm not going to focus too much on that. The other argument is about policy, okay, and the importance of strong governance over public education. The framers recognized the importance by creating a state superintendent to supervise education, and this office must be an independent office with a focus on education. That focus includes the development of regulations, and we believe that regulations in this area are best developed by educational professionals and cannot be subject to the politics and the election of the governor. Politics leads to uncertainty, and educators must have certainty in how regulations apply for the sake of the students. Let me just conclude by stating this case comes at a very critical time because educators are faced with diverse and challenging issues. This case chips away at the superintendent's authority to guide public education. And there are serious problems with rulemaking that is subject to a partisan office which is not focused on education. The educational community believes, and we cannot fall into the fix-it trap where there is no broken system.
Counsel, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate the perspective that you bring educators all across the state. I just, are you making a prudential argument or a constitutional argument?
Both.
Okay. On the constitutional side, is it your position that the legislature would not have the authority to repatriate to itself all legislative authority with respect to educational matters in the state of Wisconsin?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So right now, they have delegated some legislative authority to the SBI. Could it, as the vernacular has been used today, could it claw it all back?
Could
the legislature claw back all legislative authority with respect to educational matters in the
state
of
Wisconsin. Yeah, I don't want to get in. I mean, the superintendent, the state superintendent has got to be an independent authority. Right. And the legislature determines how much authority for the state superintendent. But the governor cannot usurp that authority.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps, sadly, I do not require a higher podium.
Mr. Essenberg, will you address whether we have to also overturn Thompson versus Crane under your analysis? It sounds like we do.
I don't think that you have to. I think that there is broad language in Thompson that a decision in this case might necessarily clarify and perhaps pull back a bit. Thompson's language was, I think, far broader than it had to be. It seems to me that this court could decide this case in favor of the petitioners by concluding that a delegated rulemaking is a legislative power. It is not a supervisory power. That matter is disputed between the parties in this case. Or this case could, or this court could read Thompson as a case which says that there is some inherent administrative or executive supervisory power that remains within the superintendent of public instruction. And the real problem with what happened in Thompson is that it more or less rendered the superintendent superfluous. But that's not the case here. Rulemaking is not a supervisory authority. It is a legislative power.
As we have a history of when there is an alleged constitutional problem with the statute, to interpret it in a way that makes it constitutional. If we would just adopt opposing parties' arguments, we might be able to interpret the statute to modify the governor's authority so that it was advisory, perhaps, rather than being able to essentially veto the rulemaking that was done by DPI. What would you think of that?
Well, as a general matter, I think constitutional avoidance is an important toolbox, important tool in this court's toolbox. But I don't think it, I'm afraid it's not going to work here because the legislature did not simply want to give the governor and the department administration advisory authority.
Mm-hmm.
It wanted to have them act as a check on administrative rulemaking because the legislature understands that it cannot oversee the making of every rule. One of the things that Act 57 did, the RAINS Act, is it said that any agency that makes a rule that has an economic impact of over $10 million, that rule cannot go into effect until the legislature adopts it. Because
well, you're not grumbling about that, though.
I'm
are
not
you?
Grumbling about that, but no. I think it reflects what the legislature is after here. The legislature is concerned about regulatory capture. It is concerned about the people who are being regulated taking control of administrative agencies, and it wants to have a more accountable officer, the governor, exercise a check on.
But the
administrative rulemaking.
The legislature can always say no thank you to the rule and just not enact them into law. I mean, we give them rules, too, from this court. Mostly they take them, but, you know, sometimes they don't. They change them and they don't enact what we did as a rule. They decide something else might be better for the courts. So, you
yes,
know, I don't,
although
I think that they could still exercise authority over the DPI and the SPI if the governor's power was not to veto, but just to, he can give a statement whether he thinks it's bad, good, or indifferent, and the legislature can look at that and say, the governor thinks that this is not good legislation, so we're not going to enact it into a law. It's a rule, but it's not going anywhere.
The legislature could decide that no rule goes into effect unless it enacts the rule into law. Right. The legislature historically has not done that.
I know.
Because given the size of the administrative state, it would really be unworkable.
Well, it'd be and a lot of work. There's no question.
Right. And so what it has chosen to do is adopt a procedural safeguard. If that procedural safeguard is taken away, then not only is the legislature frustrated in the way in which it seeks to exercise its delegated or to delegate its authority, but it will be disincentivized.
But I don't think all of the other agencies, counsel, if I may, I don't think all of the other agencies have the constitutional grumble that the superintendent presents. There are many agencies that make rules, and I agree the legislature is not going to want to nitpick all of those rules. But in this case, it really is quite focused if it's just rules dealing with education.
That would be, my light is on, may I answer?
Yeah, yes, please do. Obviously, I want to know your answer. I wouldn't be bugging you about it.
I don't think that the state superintendent has a constitutional grumble here about the exercise of delegated rulemaking, given the clear text of Article 10, Section 3, and given the nature of supervisory authority, which is, I think, at most, as you pointed out in your coin dissent, a grant of unspecified executive authority. Making rules is not executive authority. The superintendent will retain a great deal of executive and administrative authority, which he or she will exercise without interference with the governor, even should the petitioners prevail in this case.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for very, very interesting arguments in really good briefs and for bringing this case back to us. I have to say, when it first got filed, I was not really excited about seeing it again 2 years later, because when I read it, I couldn't quite see through how you were not just saying, redo coin, okay? I still have a little problem that way, but I have some other thoughts about it. So anyway, your briefs were very good, and the arguments were excellent, as usual. You're all pros, so it's really fun to hear these arguments. We will now adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:30. We are adjourned.